Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 9th, 2012. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, Michael Fairbrother from Moonlight Meadery shares his success story of going from home brewer to owner of a fast-growing commercial meadery. He also answers your questions from Facebook and Twitter. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can find me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And we have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show, and we greatly appreciate your support. We have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And you can find our iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores, and we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory and on Stitcher, the Stitcher app as well. I'm going to head on into our chat with Michael for two reasons. First of all, we talked for a good long time and covered a lot of ground, and I'm recording this episode a few days ahead of time because good friends are coming into town for a visit. You know, as soon as we sip the first homebrew from our own fermenters, we homebrewers have the itch to go pro and sell our wares to the world. Well, Michael Fairbrother is no exception, but he wanted to ease into the professional world part-time. But it was a challenge from a professional brewer that made him take the leap full-time instead. Well, Michael Fairbrother, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Happy to be here.
We met in person. What was it? It was during club or pro night. Was it in San Diego when we first met, actually in person?
No, that was actually Florida.
Was it? Holy smokes.
Yeah, that was a homebrewer back then, but I was you guys caught me in one of the clips, but it was in San Diego where you talked to me as a professional.
Okay. Well, yeah, you made the jump. I mean, you your story is an interesting story. You started out wanting to go just part-time, right, in your garage?
Right. Back in 2006, I was, you know, president of Brew Free or Die, and I used to go to club meetings all the time, and I'd pull out bottles of mead, and I noticed a really strong trend of when I opened my beer, my buddies hung around. When I started opening up bottles of mead, every woman in the room was usually knocking her husband or boyfriend over to make sure they got a chance to try some. And so at that time, I said, I'm going to start this company and do it part-time in my garage. And it took me a few years because I was too nervous to try to really figure out how to do this. I was an executive in a software company. But in spring of 2009, I was at the Craft Brewers Conference here in Boston. My friends from Boston Beer Company got me in to tour and talk around to professional brewers. And I was talking to Omar from Surly Brewing Company and telling him of my goal here to start this company part-time. And he literally changed my life with one sentence. He looked at me and he said to me, how can you possibly think you can do something you love part-time? Well, I'd never been challenged like that before, and I couldn't figure one way to argue with him. So that summer I spent working on my business plan, and by September I won my third straight Mead Maker of the Year in the New England Regional Homebrew Competition, and I won Best of Show, which had 353 entries from all the United States and Canada. And that was, as they say, the last straw, and came home, started working on my business, the application, and we got our licenses by May. Quit my day job on July 8th, 2010, and we sold almost 100,000 bottles in the last 25 months.
Now, have you had any growing pains growing that fast?
Yeah, that's been the biggest learning curve for me, which is the growth consumes a lot of capital. So we're working to manage cash flow at this point. You know, I did sell a portion of the business off to my parents. I was lucky to have them to step up and offer to back me a little bit. But it's been, you know, nonstop. This here at the shop, you know, we do roughly 25% of all of our business. So every weekend we're doing tours on the half an hour. and we're open 7 days a week. And we just heard that we have a bus tour group coming down for the whole summer next year every Saturday. So that's 55 people pretty much guaranteed to be coming through the front doors it once a week.
Wow. Now, how describe your outfit now. Describe your facilities.
Yeah, so we started in my garage, which is about 400 square feet, and now we're at 4,000 square feet. So our biggest size for men are currently is 500 gallons, and we have six of those. They're all jacketed. So we ferment at 62 degrees. It's roughly a three-month start-to-finish process. We use a staggered yeast nutrient regime. We still hand bottle everything by hand. So that's where we get to the slowest part of the process. We can basically, with four of us, do 600 bottles an hour at this point.
Wow. Literally a bottleneck.
Yes.
So are there plans to expand into an automated bottling facility? Or?
Yeah, when the time makes right. We've got capacity right now to do over 250,000 bottles a year. With our nationwide distribution agreement that we just announced, we're going to need to get to that level. And we're just about to buy our first 100-barrel fermenter, which will give us capacity to almost 100 or 500,000 bottles a year.
Gosh. Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, at the time of my life.
You've got to be pinching yourself. But it's got to be a little scary, too.
It was terrifying, but when I... The biggest obstacle for me to ever go from, and I was an executive in a software company, to go from, extraordinarily high income to, putting everything on the line, it came down to a choice of, in 2009, me looking at everything and saying, if I can't invest in myself, who can I invest with? Mm-hmm. So, think of where the stock markets were going, looking at everything being lost and software companies were outsourcing work overseas, left, right, and center. And I was tired of trying to explain the difference between a software engineer and a programmer in a foreign country, and the skill sets aren't the same. So it was the right thing, and I'm not ever going to regret it. I'm having literally the time of my life. I couldn't, I make over 58 different varieties of mead. That's more than any other meadery in the world.
Wow. Now, 58 varieties.
Right.
So, I mean, how do you get 58? How do you get 58 different varieties?
My mom taught me how to cook as a child, and she never cooked the same recipe twice. So she never followed recipe books. She always thought through flavors. And so as she taught me how to cook, that really stuck in my mind. So when I was in high school, I was thinking I was either going to go become a chef or going to go into computer science. And both of them seem rather opposite ends of the spectrum, but both involve a lot of creativity. So when I was in high school, I was probably 14, I started working at a restaurant here in New Hampshire. And I realized real quick that working in a kitchen in the summer is ungodly hot. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big guy, and heat does not do me the best. So I immediately went with computer science. And the funny anecdote to my life was, in high school, my guidance counselor told me not to even bother going to college. He said, you'd never make it in computer science. You're just going to waste your money. Just give it up and go to a vocational tech school. So I went on to become a chief architect and then a vice president of engineering. And my last full-time job was a chief operating officer in a software company. So don't ever let anybody tell you what you can't do. Usually ask these people to get out of the way so you can just do what you need to do. And so thinking through flavors is really, just – it's like asking me how do I breathe. It's kind of like some days it's really easy. I've got some coffee sitting around because we make a coffee mead. I got some vanilla because we make a coffee and vanilla. And I'm looking at some chocolate or cocoa nibs, and I'm thinking, boy, I bet you the combination of all three of those would go great. And we have our latest release, which we called Seduction. And we've sold we bottled 50 cases 2 weeks ago, and we're down to just 15 cases left.
Hmm. So how many of those 58 varieties get repeated?
Quite a bit of them. We got roughly 30 that we keep in rotation. Some of them are pretty, esoteric and not something we're going to keep in heavy rotation. I make one with habaneros and another one with habaneros and chocolate. Those are pretty small batches, maybe, 200-bottle batch size. But some of our biggest ones are currently 500 gallons. We get 5,000 bottles per batch.
Wow. So the, do you have to, I mean, having that, that wide selection of varieties, does that run into issues with labeling with the government or printing labels? Or?
Yeah, everything's a challenge. So the fact that we make wine from honey means that every recipe I create has to be approved by the federal government. So the TTB basically has a division where I put together a formula, send it into them, and they more or less rubber stamp it depending on what the ingredients are. At that point, we then get the formula back and I have to go submit the label for approval. And the COLA certified online label application process is you know, the first label took me 10 tries to get it correct. And then we tried to make one that mentioned that it was aged and fermented in Sam Adams Utopias barrels, and we just wanted to say aged in barrels. We couldn't use the word aged on our label, so I finally had to change it to the word conditioned in the so that, that, you know, whatever rules that applies to, I have no idea. But, you know, and our wines range from 13% up to 18% in strength. So that's why we have, you know, nice small 375 milliliter bottles, which, you know, the 18% bottle of mead at 375 milliliters is enough to put most people into a happy place.
And enough, maybe a permanently happy place.
Yeah, our tagline is romance by the glass. And, you know, like I said, when we were starting, you know, I bring it to homebrew parties and the ladies were really going crazy for it. So I really thought that that's who I was going to target my, my marketing campaign to is women, not to Renaissance fairs, not to, you know, the Wiccan community, not that there's anything wrong with either one of those groups. But I really wanted to make a mainstream or a new category of beverage, more like how cider came back into, you know, popularity back in the mid-80s, and look at what it's doing now. I mean, I look at all the other meaderies in the world as, you know, think of the market opportunity as a football field, and we're all specks of dust on this football field. If we get to be the size of a football, we're really happy. And we probably still will never see each other. So, I mean, I really think of them as my colleagues instead of my competitors, because it's, to me, when I was watching, you know, the professional brewers and how they interact, you know, I'm good personal friends with Mitch Steele from Stone Brewing Company. And to see how, you know, the brewing community can support each other to find jobs and to allow individuals to grow in their community is really inspiring. And that's kind of when I started my own company, what I wanted to be all about. And so we get phone calls from other different meaderies or potential startup meaderies across the country. And I'm always happy to answer a question and go out of my way to do whatever I can to help them, because I've been helped along my way by plenty, and I certainly will never forget that.
Speaking of answering questions, we got lots of questions on Facebook and Twitter. Do you want to start fielding some of those?
Sure, go for it.
Scott from Facebook says, I have no business background but would love to start working in this business. How does one get started? Also, do you need a pilot for your private jet, he says.
Well, I ain't making money yet. Let's see. No business background. So you can – everybody can make mead. Mead is not the hardest beverage in the world to make. But that being said, it takes an awful lot of skill to make great mead. And you could come in with video cameras and tape me making every single batch, and I could publish every recipe I make. But the key difference is I make them based on taste, and I determine the readiness based on my flavor, my sensory analysis of the mead. So I haven't run my own company before. I can tell you that's been the hardest part of the job, which is, you know, managing employees isn't too hard, you know, relatively speaking. But, you know, trying to manage cash flow, manage, you know, business contracts, thinking through strategy of where do you want to go, how do you help motivate, you know, a distributor in California where, you know, you're going to be there maybe once a year to come out and do tastings. You know, you need an awful lot of good connections and a lot of great friends. I mean, this isn't something, I wouldn't ever want to talk anybody out of starting their own company. I think, you know, that fear of the unknown really keeps a lot of people working for other people when they don't necessarily have to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I joke around that I'm poor, but on paper the company is, you know, starting to do pretty well, and it's just, you know, balancing how much debt we have versus, you know, where we want to put that money.
Yeah, it's a lot of it's just piling the profits back into it, right?
Right. Well, especially when you're buying 100 barrel fermenters, or, you know, we bought, you know, 10,000 pounds of honey in the month of May, you know, even at bulk wholesale prices, that's still pretty pricey. And then you need bottles, and bottles aren't cheap, and labels, and it just keeps going.
So what type of honey, Dave Reagan, who's sent us some honey, he's a beekeeper down in Little Rock, what types of honey do you use, and what's your turnaround time from ferment to bottle?
Sure. So we use mostly wildflower honey. And, you know, I love to tell people that we use just New Hampshire honey, but unfortunately we use way more honey than the state of New Hampshire produces. So we've partnered up with McClure's Maple and Honey out of Littleton, New Hampshire, who is a true source certified honey supplier. And what that big fancy title means is they can track it back to the beehive and show me every step of the way the honey comes through the process. So I'm very confident with the quality of the honey that I get. But we also use Tupelo blossom, Brazilian pepper, almond, cranberry, blueberry blossom, and I just secured roughly 10,000 pounds of honey from Scotland from my friends at Boston Beer Company. So they used to make honey brown ale, honey brown porter, I guess, and they had some extra honey, and we were able to secure that. I'm probably going to be making some of that for sale to homebrewers as well.
And Boston Beer Company is known for sharing ingredients. They have shared hops with other brewers during the hop crisis and such as that. So they're good ones to have a relationship with, it seems like.
Yeah, I used to run their homebrew competition up here in Boston for 4 years. So I've got some really, really amazing friends at the company, and I'll cherish that forever from, you know, every aspect I can see. I mean, Jim Cook has signed bottles of Utopias for me over the years, and really appreciate that generosity they've had for us.
Matt asks, how does one account for the flavor differences from different batches of honey for a mead? For example, I find wildflower honey can taste different in the summer versus the fall from the same supplier. What do you do to...
He's correct.
Yeah, what do you do to make it consistent?
You can't. You basically have to do your best in... either having material, you know, finished mead that you can blend back together, or think about where the flavor is going to go. So when we're making our central, which are wildflower honey mead, you know, I try to get the earliest season honey I can, because I find that a little lighter in flavor. And our honey comes to us almost as fast as, you know, we order it, it comes to us the next day, and it's in the fermenter the day after that. So we do not pasteurize any of the honey that we use. We use a no heat method. We only heat it up to 80 degrees so that we can run it through our pump, and then we put it into a mixing tank where we add the cold water. So it's, you know, it's really hard. I try hard to explain to people how much honey can vary based on weather, based on time of year, based on flower source. Fruit also varies. So if you're making a fruit mead, like the apple cider from early season fall apples is quite a bit more tart and tannic than the ones from late season apples.
So I guess that leads back to your cooking background and tasting your ingredients and just imagining how the combination is going to be.
Right. So it's really just a question of, you know, I've got a palette, and I've got, you know, it's like painting. So I've figured out where I'm starting from and where do I want to take it to.
So several people asked about yeast. What yeast do you use?
We pretty much use a standard yeast across the board, which is Lavelin 71B. It's a white wine yeast from Narbonne, France. It's rated for 14% alcohol, but that's the only yeast I use, and I can measure that we've gotten our meads up to 18%. So, and we really strive never to back sweeten a mead. So to work that, you know, you have to really, you know, understand the yeast and how you're going to manage it during the fermentation process and how the nutrients are going to help it along, and then be prepared prepared to stop it if you have to, with nutrient or not nutrients, with sulfites and sorbates if you really want to. But for the most part, we're trying to go sulfite and sorbate free until we start having sparkling bottles of mead. And I said, this isn't going to work very well.
Sparkling bottles of mead can turn into bottle bombs if you're not careful.
Well, they just explode the corks right out the top. So yeah, it's not it's not a question of exploding the bottle, but it certainly makes a mess and creates a nightmare for customer relations.
Broken Wings Brew from Twitter says, what are the best options for carbonating a finished batch of mead without getting bottle bombs?
I would suggest, force carbonated, certainly the easiest way to carbonate up a mead if you're going to keg it. I'm trying to, actually, my fiance and I are getting married on August 31st, and we're making a sparkling mead for our wedding. And I opened a bottle yesterday, and it's in champagne-style bottles. So we basically took a tupelo blossom honey, still had some residual sweetness. We filtered it, but not sterile filtered it, and bottled it. And I've got it sitting up here in my office, which is about 75 to 80. And we opened our first test bottle yesterday, barely starting to sparkle at this point. So I got another month, but it may be time to bring the corkscrews to the wedding, and maybe by next year it'll be sparkling enough for our anniversary.
I made a sparkling mead for Steve Wilkes' wedding it's been years ago, and we've each got one bottle of that batch. And we're just waiting for the opportunity to, you know, the special opportunity to to open those up. Sparkling meads can be fun, and they can be very, very dry like champagne, right? I mean, is there a way to get kind of a sweeter sparkling mead?
Well, again, it's it's all got to do with, when you bottle it, how much residual sugar you have, what's the yeast tolerated for. I mean, the yeast is, the more alcohol you get put into it, the more the yeast, or, the more alcohol that's in the mead, the slower it's going to ferment, and the less likely it's going to go out to completion. So, we've made meads from 30 to 40 bricks up to 50. And I can tell you, a 50 bricks mead, you're never going to get a bones dry. It's going to be almost sweet like candy syrup. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to need to blend that down with something a little drier.
So you say that you do the staggered nutrient regime. Can you talk about that? And is there an easy way for homebrewers to attack that?
Sure. So first and foremost, go read the paper that Kurt Stock produced or put together and presented at the National Homebrewers Conference a couple of years back. So basically, you're adding, let's say it's two teaspoons of nutrients that you're going to split over four. Actually, I guess it's three teaspoons that you're going to split over four increments. So the first three go in every day for the first 24 hours. So you take your GoFirm and your Firmaid K, or you can use DAP, D-A-P. I pretty much stay away from DAP and just go with GoFirm and Firmaid K. So you can pick those up at any homebrew store. And so if you're going to start with three teaspoons, you take a quarter of it one day, a quarter of it the next, a quarter of it the third. And the last quarter goes in when you're about third the way done completion of fermentation, so that you're really giving the yeast the nutrients they need to do their job. And by controlling the temperature, like we ferment at 62 degrees, and by using the nutrients, we get a turnaround time of 3 months. And I have talked to other professional meaderies that talk about a turnaround time in 3 weeks. I can't tell you how that's being done off the top of my head, other than adding an awful lot of nitrogen, but I'm sure there's other people more skilled than I am that have been doing this much longer than I am that have really solid ways of doing it. But it's just from my experience as a home brewer, 3 months was the fastest. I wanted to see it turn around, and I'm pretty happy with that as a business owner.
So is there an issue with scaling up as far as production goes? I mean, is it a simple matter of just scaling up the recipes, or are the things happening with the larger batches that don't
with
the smaller ones?
That's a great question. So several things happen. So a really big batch will contend or stratify. So you'll have different densities of mead at the top, in the middle, and at the bottom, and that's certainly a challenge. You don't want to be measuring it off the top or off the middle and getting completely different than where you're shooting for. So you have to recirculate the mead, agitate, or otherwise degas it to keep it mixed up. Also, temperature gain. In a 55-gallon drum, you're going to see about a 7-degree gain over ambient temperature just from the fermentation. So that's why we ferment in this time of year in just refrigerated glycol-jacketed fermenters. That way, we can get a nice, clean, consistent time after time batch. And sometimes it's a little drier than where we want. Sometimes it's a little sweeter, but for the most part, we're trying to hit the same source. Same target.
What about oxygen? How do you handle oxygen?
Well, we use some pretty big pumps. So we're pumping at 26 gallons a minute, and we shoot it out of a rack and cane into the top of the 500-gallon tank. So it's splashing around. I have an oxygen system that I have for my beer or more beer brewery at home, and I just haven't cranked up there, found the need yet to actually try to work with that. We haven't really tried to push the upper end of like 23% alcohol or 19%. We've been able to get by with just natural oxygen or aeration into the meads.
So do you add air or oxygen just at the beginning of fermentation, or do you nurse it along a little bit?
Actually, mead's completely different than beer. So you with beer, trying to keep oxygen out of it once you start the fermentation process. With mead, it's not the same. Air is actually going to help it oxidize, and that's why mead kind of gets better with time. So the ancient way of making mead was you kept it for 2 or 3 years, or I say ancient. Back when I was making mead in '95, it took 3 to 4 years for it to make, and by adding that oxygen, so like when we age, we make some mead called Utopian in our Sam Adams Utopias barrels, and that slow process of letting it sit in these barrels gives it a really, really beautiful finish. It's almost, you pick up whiffs of bourbon, you get a little coconut and vanilla notes from the oak, but the honey just softens right up. And so adding that oxygen into the process, it's called degassing as you make wine, it pulls the CO2 out of solution, because CO2 is toxic to the yeast. But by adding that oxygen back in, that'll give the yeast that the the oxygen it needs to do its job.
So yeah, what are the major differences between beer and mead? I mean, what is there a complete shift between the two?
Well, so you're not converting starch to sugar, so like there's no mashing. You can make a braggot, which is a mead with malt. Although as a meadery, you have a choice. You can either go with a brewery license or a winery license. There's pros and cons to either way. If I went with a brewery license, then the state of New Hampshire would control every label I produced, and I would be limited to the amount of alcohol I can make. By going with a winery license, I'm now controlled by the TTB on my wine license or labels, but I can go up to 23% alcohol without a challenge. And then we can't have malt on the premise. So I can never make a braggot here unless I get a brewery and a winery license. And then I could section off a portion of the meadery to be a brewery portion. It's complicated.
Laws, you gotta love them. There's a question about back sweetening. Mike asks details on back sweetening and or cold or crash cooling at a certain gravity, and he'd like to know if there are any yeasts that won't attenuate too far and will leave it sweet without needing to back sweeten or crash cool. He says bread yeasts, perhaps. I don't guess a commercial meadery would ever want to mess with bread yeast, but different yeasts have different properties and.
Yeah, there's a so Scott Labs out in California has a great little handbook. It's called their catalog, and any brewer can go get a hold of this, and it'll tell you about every type of wine yeast that's out there. And I swear by this thing. It tells you the nutrient regimes. It talks to you about sulfiting and how that works. I mean, it's a great little handbook, and they put it together for professional wineries. And granted, most homebrewers aren't going to need a 500-kilogram block of yeast, but the material is still really valuable to read.
So what about sour meads? Have you thought about doing those?
Yeah, we actually got a couple going right now. So, like I mentioned, I got great friends. Well, Rob Todd of Allagash Brewing Company helped us with his help of his professional brewer, or brewmaster, Jason Perkins, get a couple Curio barrels. And we're doing a wildly spontaneous fermented mead in these barrels that we're calling Curiosity. And so we're planning on going a full 3 years before we even try it. So we'll let the pellicle settle on the top and really see what it can do to the mead and the complexity of it. I'm a big fan of Belgian lambics, and I've been to Cantillon, and I've seen how they make their beer. So we're trying some of my tried-and-true homebrewing methods for trying to make a sour mead.
Is anybody doing sour meads?
Yeah, there's a couple actually coming out these days. I think Bee Nectar may be having one, or there's rumors they're coming out with one. And I know the Sap House Meadery guys just released a kombucha-style sour mead.
Sean Coates asks, what about spoilage organisms, and if you've ever had to dump a batch?
Well, we haven't had to thus far. I do have one that we're keeping an eye on. We had an employee that didn't put the lid back on it after it was in bulk aging, and that has me very worried. So we're measuring the acidity level on it now and doing sensory analysis on it, and I'm working with my insurance company to figure out what may be covered or not covered under such a loss. But personally, I've never lost a batch, and I hope that stays the same as my company goes forward, and we would be devastated to lose such a big batch of mead. But,
and you said that you only heat the honey up to 80 degrees. Is that Fahrenheit,
right,
or Celsius?
Fahrenheit. And okay, the reason why we only do 80 degrees is because we're just trying to move it through a hose. So we're using 2-inch non-collapsible hoses to move the honey from the totes into the mixing tank. So we get our honey now in 3,200-pound blocks. Looks like the biggest sippy cup you ever saw. And once it's up and online, it's in the mixing tank, we're adding cold water immediately.
So we're talking about around 26 C for those with the better temperature scale. But you don't, a lot of people pasteurize their honey because they're worried about spoilage organisms.
Yeah, I've never had a problem. So we pitch our yeast at 1 gram per gallon. So in a 500-gallon batch, we're rehydrating and getting the yeast fully active before we pitch it into the must. And I've never had a problem. Never had a problem as a home brewer. And I know there's a religious debate out there about whether you need to heat it or not. And, my personal preference is do what you like. And, if you make great meads heating it up, prove me wrong. That's wonderful. I mean, I just got some homebrewed mead in. I have no idea how it was heated or not. I think Tom won Mead Maker of the Year this year out of Minnesota, and I can tell you it's spectacular. So however he's doing it, keep doing it, Tom.
Whatever works for you. You talk about Donald asks about a pH range. What do you adjust the pH of your must? And add an acid concentration at any point?
Yeah, so pH is really critical in many aspects. So first, it's got to do with how healthy your yeast is going to ferment. So certain types of fruits that we use, whether it's black currants, rhubarb, really have quite a sour note to it. And sometimes it comes out so tart that you're trying to figure out what on earth are you going to do with this thing. I made a black currant and rhubarb mead that I was really, dumbfounded what I was going to do because it was so tart. I thought my jaw was going to lock up, because it's a reaction to the tartness. And so on that particular mead, instead of trying to adjust the pH with chemicals, I used a bacteria for a malolactic fermentation, which really transitioned one form of acid to the next. I think it creates malolactic, or takes I'm not always the most technical guy, but it basically the end result was phenomenal, and that was one of the meads that got us to the Boston Wine Expo this year. And we were the first, one of the first New Hampshire wineries ever to be at that event, and it really does create a difference. So, you know, measure your pH. You know, the specified tolerances based on each yeast strain. It's good to stay within that tolerance. If you're outside the tolerance, things are going to slow down. You could get stuck fermentations. And then the sweetness really really matters. So, like, we made one called Mojo, which is based off a homebrewer's recipe, Mike Manning, out of – I think he's out of Pennsylvania. He won the Valhalla Meeting of Life last year. And Mike's recipe had lime, mint, orange blossom honey, and – it was spectacular. And so he made his carbonated, which the carbonation gave it a nice little carbonic bite. And I didn't want to go the carbonation route, so I added a little bit more lime juice than he would have added to his recipe. But that lime juice added that citric acid that really held that sweetness within check. So, you know, I really look for a balance in my flavor. So when my even my sweetest meads are still quite balanced, and, well, some of them show real high on a Brix scale for sweetness, my hope and my goal is to have the perception to be a little more balanced.
So you prefer adding natural acidic ingredients rather than, say, just an acid blend or something?
Yeah, that's a, so we do have everything. So we have citric acid here. You know, my friends tell me it's cheaper to use citric acid than lime juice, but, you know, when you're looking at something you're trying to make from, like, my experience levels from home, it's much easier to go clear out 10 of the local grocery stores of all the real lime juice they have and use that versus trying to figure out how to dose it to the right level with citric acid. At some point, someday, I may have enough resources to hire a chemist on board to really kind of walk me through some of this stuff. But, you know, for now, it's still pretty much, you know, how would I do it as a home brewer and how do I keep track of it?
At what point do you give up the reins as the mead maker?
That's a great question.
Are you gonna?
I got no plans to do it. I'm having such a time of my life. I think at some point I may be doing more, you know, touring, talking to people about the process, doing tastings. I mean, we just got back from Seattle, amazing event for us. I've been out to California. You know, I've got trips out to Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and it's great for me to interact with fans, and that's why I still do tours here at the Meadery during the weekends, because it's, you know, I love to see the reaction of people when they try it for the first time. And you asked a question before about back sweetening. You know, we tend not to try to back sweeten the meads. We really work hard to have the sweetness level up front, and so the yeast will die before we actually, you know, or give up before it actually gets too dry.
An interesting question. Christopher asked, I recently had a mead at a club meeting, and the maker said that at first the mead tasted awful, after which he left the mead out in the sun in his backyard, just because, I suppose, he says. I imagine there's no fear of skunking because of the lack of hops, but could the sun potentially have an effect on a simple honey water yeast mead? So have you experienced anything with sun striking the sun having an impact on it?
Yeah, so the sun shouldn't have any impact other than possibly warming it up where the yeast kicked in again and changed the flavor profile. So yeast can consume all sorts of, you know, like diacetyl or any of these other characteristics. So that's the only thing I can think offhand that might have happened with it.
So the sun, the warmth for the sunlight might have just woken the yeast back up, and they got back to work and finished the job.
that's my guess on it, but time always makes a difference.
Oh, Paul's asking for the recipe for your fantastic strawberry rhubarb mead. Honey,
okay.
Honey, strawberry, rhubarb, and water, right?
Yeah, it's pretty close. So we use equal parts of strawberry and rhubarb. Basically, at our scale, we're using juice or concentrated juice. We love to use as much local fruits as we can. Sometimes we're challenged by how do we process that into make juice. So, you know, nothing beats fresh strawberries and fresh rhubarb. Second to that, go, you know, get strawberry juice or rhubarb juice and make a mead from that. And again, you gotta really taste. Taste the flavors and know what that does for it. And the best last tip I have for you is use orange blossom honey. When we made the same recipe with wildflower honey, it just didn't have that same citrus note that really kind of makes it perfect at this point. And this month, Fling, which is my strawberry rhubarb mead in my shop, became our bestseller. So it's pretty popular.
So on the homebrew scale, if you've got fresh rhubarb and fresh strawberries, you don't just throw the stuff in there. Would you put it through a food processor, or how would you do that?
Well, strawberries you can freeze, and I used to use frozen strawberries all the time to make mead. Rhubarb, I don't know how they actually make it into juice, but I would imagine you could freeze it, chop it up and freeze it, and put it in there as a puree as well, and you get the same flavor. I like almost 4 pounds per gallon of my fruit, which really gives you a really nice fruity note to it. But when you're dealing with any kind of fruit in a mead, you need to punch the cap down. And the cap is the fruit layer on the top of the mead. And you want to do that 2 or 3 times per day during the initial couple weeks of fermentation. And that's because what's happening is the fruit blanket, or the cap, is keeping the heat of this fermentation in the mead. And you don't want to keep that heat build up there, because even though it may be cool at the bottom, or you're measuring the room temperature, or you're measuring the temperature of the vat, if you have any one section of the batch getting warmer, that yeast is in and it acting differently than the rest of the yeast is acting. Mm. So by punching down the cap, I've found that really, really makes a huge difference. And we make a blueberry mead called Wild, and we use a lot of blueberries. It's almost 2,000 pounds of blueberries in a 500-gallon batch. And I can tell you, it's a lot of work to stir those blueberries up in the top, but nothing beats that flavor once you get it and do it right.
So Theodore asks, is it better to add the fruit to the must, or do primary fermentation and then add the fruit to it, say, in the secondary?
We add everything at primary. So we never add fruit in secondary. We never add spice in primary. We always do anything fermentable goes in primary. And when we're getting into secondary stages, that's where we'll start adding spice to make a methaglen, for example.
And so what do you do back when you were a home brewer? All that pulp, all that fruit can be quite messy. How do you deal with that? How do you get a clear mead out of that?
A lot of racking. For example, when 2,000 pounds of blueberries is done, we usually haul it off to our local farmers, and they feed it to the cows and pigs. And I can tell you, I wouldn't want to go back the next day to see what's going on around that farmyard. But once it's racked, the fruit will float up to the top, and so you can rack out from underneath it. So you need a nice racking cane to do that.
You've got drunk cows.
We've probably challenged intestinal disorders.
Oh, man. Secret City Brews from Twitter asks, can we add sparkaloid to drop yeast and clarify in the primary fermenter, then long-term age mead in a keg?
I would say that's possible. I haven't actually done that before, so I can't really add a lot of commentary on that one.
That's a good answer. It's always a good answer to say, I don't know. I'm not sure. Let's see. Think about Twitter. Oh, Ben. The little username. Sometimes you can't tell who's who. Ben asks, how do you target your final gravity properly? His last mead shot right past the published alcohol tolerance for the yeast.
Yeah, the best answer I have for that is really get to know your yeast and trial and error. So I've been making mead since July of 95, and I used to do that quite a bit. And so I started trying to isolate down how do I refine my skills, and that's why I've narrowed in on Lavalin 71B and how I know this yeast is exactly what it can do, what pH range it can live in, and how it likes certain fruits better than others, and what does it need or what is it missing, what's it going to do to a tupelo blossom honey, or how's heather honey going to come out. Good questions, and some of that I don't know.
That's a good strategy, especially if you guys are making dozens of varieties of mead. Having one thing to be standard, being your yeast, it seems like that would that would alleviate a lot of headaches down the line.
Yeah, it's one less variable to paint with. And so if I literally think of the flavors I create as more or less works of art. And if I'm starting with a canvas and my canvas is my yeast, I can then at least look at where do I want to take the other flavors to push it where I want to go.
One important ingredient that we haven't talked about is water. How do you, what's your water makeup, and do you do anything to tweak it or?
Nope, it's the same water I've been using for since 95. It's town municipal water supply. We take it in. We do not heat it, filter it, or do anything else to it. It does change over the time of the course of the summer. It's coming out of a lake up here in New Hampshire called Lake Massabesic. And I brewed with it too, so I never really had to work too hard on additions or salts to the brewing waters. I'm not sure exactly what that would really do for a mead anyway. Usually trying to get some different, you know, with the hopping rates for beer, for example. And I haven't really played around with trying to make a hop mead at this point, although I've got a 20-gallon brewery at the house that I'm itching to put to use, and I'm thinking of making a 20-gallon batch of hop tea that I can then take here and blend the honey in and see what it's going to come out to be like.
Mm. So you don't even filter for chlorine?
No.
Wow. That's going to be surprising to a lot of people.
Well, that's not. I mean, if the water tastes good, then I'm drinking a cup of it here right now. You know, I'd say go with it. If it's tasting or smelling funky, I mean, it's not. New Hampshire's pretty. How do I put it? Not quite cow town, but you know, there's some good populations in and around. But I mean, it's fairly suburbs.
I always love to hear professional brewers say things that go against. Common wisdom, you know, like always get the chlorine out of your water. Well, you know, here's a professional mead maker who makes awesome meads that I've tasted, and he doesn't.
Yeah, it's really if you know, to get to know me is to understand that I'm a seat of the pants type of guy. I mean, I look at it as if they can be making mead for tens of thousands of years. You know, I've got a little bit of knowledge that gives me a huge leg up on how this is done. And that's why I say it's more artisanal than just a process. You know, it literally what I can taste and what I, you know, people ask me all the time to, will you make this recipe? You know, I pick on watermelon because it's not one of my favorite flavors. And I looked at the first person that asked me to make watermelon meat, and I said, go for it. Start your own company. Make your own watermelon meat. I wasn't trying to be terse. I can't think of the flavor in a positive way. I'm never going to make it because I make everything I make for me. The fact that I got other people that love it is just a bonus, because I look at it, if nobody ever buys a bottle, I'm drinking it. And I want to drink what I like.
So where can we find it? Where can we find your meads?
Yeah, so right now huge news. We assigned a distribution deal with St. Killian's Importing, which is going to be bringing us to all 50 states. So they're taking us to 12 more states. The order's leaving the dock tomorrow. So we're going to be – right now we're in all of New England and California, so from Napa Valley all the way down to San Diego in California, and, you know, every state in New England. But the expansion's going to include New York, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Florida, Texas, Illinois, Colorado, and Washington State. I think I got them all. Oh, and Nevada.
Wow.
So yeah, it's pretty huge. You know, and their initial order, which we expect to be just a token, was one of the biggest orders we've ever had in our corporate history.
Now you've got a finder on your website for people who want to go and see where it is.
So we have two ways you can look it up. So one, we have a where to buy, and you can enter in the state and you'll get a listing per state, or you can enter area codes, etc. But we also created a Google map so you can search. And as soon as my distributors tell us where they're putting it, I'll update the information on the website. Often that's not the easiest challenge because – you know, they're really busy with every other product that they're trying to sell, and sending me an updated list of accounts isn't always a priority. But if customers find my product anywhere, please let me know, and I'll help share it with everybody else.
And people can follow you, Moonlight Mead, on Twitter.
Correct.
And your website is moonlightmeadery.com?
Yes. And we can ship to 17 states right now. I don't have a complete list, but there's a online web page for that, too.
And unfortunately, Arkansas is not on that list. You know, whenever I ask people when, how far is your distribution going, my inside question, the question that's inside my head is always, when is it going to come to Northwest Arkansas? So,
well, it's my goal. It would be as soon as you start telling stores you want to buy the product, and they contact their distributor, and their distributor contacts St. Killian's, we can make it happen. My goal is to, we've already shipped product to Australia, so my goal is to make it. A lot of my friends tell me I'm crazy to be growing so fast, and why would you want to have product in Australia, or why are you trying to, you know, what's the goal? My goal is I want to share what I love. I want to make the product I'm making and keep it honest and real. But, you know, if people want something to taste great, they're going to demand it. And if you think back when Ben and Jerry's started, and you know, I don't know the facts to all this stuff, but it's a story I tell here at the shop, because I can remember when ice cream was roughly 79 cents a half gallon. And you can imagine what the poor guys at Ben and Jerry's went through when they probably told their investors or, you know, the market that they were going to be selling this for $3.50 a pint to $5. And, you know, you can imagine what people looked at them like they had two or three different heads. Well, you give people a choice. They'll demand choice. They want flavor. They want, you know, I can't wait for the day I walk into a Mexican restaurant and I don't get greeted with just a bowl of chips and salsa. I get asked, which salsa would you like tonight, Mr. Fairbrother? Mm. Want some mango, some, you know, habanero? Give me a choice. I'd pay extra for it. I'm tired of just being given the least common denominator. I want to enjoy everything I can taste to the maximum. And if that means, you know, you're only getting the lowest based for you, and this is what we're giving away, it's a perfect opportunity to do something different that people will just tell their friends about.
Well, you're preaching to the choir. I think not only me, but everybody who's listening, I think, is saying, yeah. And I wish you continued success, and I hope that you continue to make the wonderful meads that I've tasted. And I can't wait till I get to buy them myself.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
All right, have a great day.
Well, thanks again to Michael. You know, I'm embarrassed that I forgot that we met first way back in at the Homebrew Conference in Orlando. And that was way back in 2006. And I went back and looked, and sure enough, there he is. We Steve and I were walking around Pro Night and talking to the homebrewers that were walking around there. And there he is, Michael Fairbrother. And he said on the tape that that was his first National Homebrewers Conference, and it was ours, too. That was a long time ago. I'm going to mention Moonlight Mead to the liquor stores around here and see if we can get some coming this way. And I suggest for you to look for it where you are, too. It's good stuff. If you have brewing questions for me, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online at our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are experimental and quasi-experimental designs for generalized casual inference, and Norpro mushroom egg slicer. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.